Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we are number crunching in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Well then, our return to action ended in defeat as an Alexis McAllister-inspired performance saw Liverpool go top of the table. It's a game we went into without seven first-choice players, but a stirring performance meant we couldn't possibly got something else of the game. So there are 27 points left to play for, starting with a trip to Brentford on Wednesday, and then we have Arsenal visiting the Amex on Saturday. Last season, we derailed Arsenal's title challenge around this time. Can we do it again? Also, this week, where we've had our highest ever league finish, received record-breaking transfer fees, and had a European tour, the Albion's accounts are out, which means we've had some head-spinning figures. So that means that joining myself and Alan Wares today is our resident accountancy boffin, an egghead, a renowned expert in the field of Marmite and Joy Division. It's Kieran Maguire. Hello, Kieran. Lovely to see you. The last time I actually saw your smiling face was actually in Rome. So it's nice to see you actually went to the right restaurant this time.
Yes, it's been a busy few days in my little world. We don't have international breaks in the world of football finance. And the 31st of March period is a very special one because that's the deadline for clubs to submit their account.
Well, I mean, obviously you've been doing the rounds and your head is probably like spinning with figures of all sorts of variety. But we're going to get into the nuts and bolts of that a little bit later on. But first, I mean, the headlines, it's been quite mind-boggling that we actually announced a profit. No one announces a profit in football.
No one apart from Brighton, Hove Albion and Brentford tend to announce a profit. Because both those clubs are the poster boys in terms of sustainability, in terms of investing in infrastructure, in terms of being willing to go to those markets where the bigger clubs tend to turn their noses up. And as a consequence of that, they've both been financially successful and that's allowed them to A, get to the Premier League and B, to become substantial parts of the Premier League and get huge admiring glances, not just from the UK, but from overseas as well. For the way that Tony Bloom runs the club, the way that Paul Barber runs the club, players and coaches as well.
Now, I mean, you've said on a very good podcast, I can't remember what it's called, that the price of cheese or something, the price of football, of course, Kieran. You say nobody gets into football to make money. It's a vanity project. So the fact that we've announced a record-breaking figure is just incredible.
It is. I think it's fair to say that all of our ducks were in a row in 22-23. The club was put into a good start of the season from Graham. And you know, he should be given credit for what he left to Roberto. The football we saw under Roberto, I've been watching the Albion for 50 years. I've never seen anything like it. It was off the scale. On the back of that, we had players who became attractive. So we lost Mark Cucurella, we lost Leandro Trossard, we lost Neil Mopay, and so on. And they all went on to bigger things, not arguably better in terms of the final league positions. And that allowed the club to generate a record amount of money coming in, more than £200 million. And to put that in context, when we left with Dean, in, 2011, it was £7 million from everything, from ticket sales, from commercial, from the TV deal. Well, that £7 million has turned into 204.
Yeah. Alan?
Now, a few weeks ago, we had Paul Cameron on the show, and I put it to him, the point that just about everyone in the media is saying, oh, Brighton, brilliantly run club, on the back of being able to find players from a relatively obscure leagues that other places aren't really looking at, coming home, coming into the club, either sending them out on loan and And then turning them to something a little bit special. And of course, McAllister and Caicedo, you know, they're players as an example. But I always felt that that was actually a little bit of a kind of a narrow remit as to how a club's internal success should be judged. Now, knowing what you know about the machinations of the club, and obviously not necessarily the day-to-day minutiae, but you see the result of what it is we're doing, there's more to it than just buying cheap, selling high. There's something else extra at the club whereby, I mean, I use the phrase ducks in a row. There's something that whatever Tony's plan was, whatever, however we could construe it, it now seems to be bearing fruition, does it not? And it's been a while doing so.
You're absolutely right. I think what we have is, first of all, you've got two people at the helm of the club who communicate with each other well, who understand each other, who challenge each other as well. That's also replicated as far as the coaching staff are concerned. I think Tony has set out what he believes Brighton and Hove Albion should be in terms of a style of play, and therefore you recruit a coach to implement that style of play. We saw in terms of Graham leaving and Roberto joining the club, there was no fuss. We've not got the constant drama that you have at Manchester United in terms of is Ten Hag going to get the sack, in which case who's going to replace him? We've now got this this melodrama in respect of Jurgen Klopp leaving. It was sorted within a couple of weeks. It was sorted in a couple of days when Chris left the club and was replaced by Graham. And all of that is to do with having a big picture, having a succession plan. And it's the dull stuff. And speaking as one of the world's dullest people, you know, I am in a position to really admire the way that the club operates. Yeah. Having a strategy, having a plan, and putting it into practice.
So with that in mind then, Kieran, I mean, obviously we love to talk about big signings here on the Raw, and we've just made another big signing today, which is off the pitch. It is massive because, I mean, you just mentioned the likes of Manchester United there, and clubs are looking to be, you know, looking at the way that the Albion are run and everything else. And the fact we've actually managed to tie down Paul Barber again for another 5 years is massive news for the club, isn't it?
I think it's absolutely fantastic. You know, what Paul has helped to achieve, and he will acknowledge that he is part of a team, but what he has helped to achieve here in that 12-year period is transformational in terms of the success of the club on the pitch, in terms of the number of staff which are employed by Brighton Hove Albion Holdings Limited. It's now more than 1,000 people, including part-time staff. But that's, you think of what it was like at Withdean. So it's providing jobs. It's increasing the profile of the club. It's increasing the profile of the city. And if I'm honest, I think he was perfectly entitled to think, I've taken the club to the six in the Premier League. I've taken the club to Europe. Do I want a fresh challenge? Because I can assure you, if he had reached that conclusion, there is a long line of clubs who would snap his hands off in order to want to work with him. I think he also acknowledges that he will not find a better club owner than Tony Bloom, because Tony does delegate responsibility. He does have a vision, which I think Paul is keen to implement, and that they do work ridiculously well together. On the back of that, I think he's decided to stay. You know, that takes us to 2030. I'll be retired by then. So
and he'll be close to it. He'll be closer to himself by then, won't he? He'll be 63 by then.
I mean, let's face it, Kieran. You are the Martin Perry of football finance.
As in, he'll never retire. He'll never be allowed to retire.
I won't.
I think it's fairly obvious that we're going to end up having to talk about Liverpool in the second half of the show, which is absolutely fine, because I think this is big news, and I think we need to play it up. So we're obviously getting to the background here of, yes, we're a well-run club. Everyone knows we're a well-run club on account of the fact that we, like I say, we buy low, sell high. And that's what people from outside, they get to witness. So, but obviously, you know, we know a little bit more than that, and possibly you know more still. So let's put some numbers on this. Let's put some meat on this bone. Let's put some numbers here. And Could you give us the headline figures, and better still, put those figures into context of not just the history of Brighton and Hove Albion, but in the history of the Premier League as well?
Okay. The Albion finished sixth in the table last season, as we know. Their revenue of £204 million will put them... We've not received all of the figures for clubs yet, but it'll put them just below halfway. Their wage bill was the 13th highest. Their squad cost at the end of the season, was the 20th highest in the Premier League.
The lowest.
So on the lowest costing squad, they achieved all that they achieved. And in terms of the player sale profits, and remember, these figures exclude the sales of Moises Caicedo and Robert Sanchez, and the player sale profits of £121 million, which was mainly, as I mentioned, Cucurella, Trossard, Mopé, and so on, that is higher than all of the player sale profits from 1901 to 2022 put together.
Are the Grand Posse and the background staff that went to Chelsea included in that as well?
Well, on top of that, the club did receive £23.5 million from Chelsea, or Brighton B, I think as we prefer to call them, in respect of compensation for Graham. I know that, you know, Graham got a hostile reception when he came back to the Amex, and I absolutely understand the reason for that. And he was a brilliant coach for us as well. I think it was the circumstances and the timing of when he left was the issue. But again, you've got to admire the club. When he'd been here for 12 weeks and then Tony Bloom says, I want you to sign a six-year contract, we all turned around as fans and going, has Tony lost it? But what Tony did is he got into that six-year contract. Yes, it was a pay rise for Graham, we see, but it also meant that the buyout clause, as far as his contract was concerned, went through the stratosphere, because we had to pay Swansea compensation when he joined, but that compensation, probably in the region of £1 million, we got 23 back. And it's that vision which I think is underappreciated or unappreciated in the media. In terms of, we know that Tony is a deep thinker. We know he's a mathematical genius, but it's his ability to be two or three steps ahead of the rest of the market, which gives the Albion that competitive edge, which allows it to be smarter but not bigger as to where we are today.
I mean, you said it a minute ago, Kieran. You said we've got up to 1,000 staff at the club now. One thing that the club does very, very well is look after the people within the organisation. You know, if there is a profit share, it's not just the players and the coaching staff. It's the tea lady. It's everybody. It's the kit man. It's everyone gets the same.
Well, that's because it comes down to the culture of the club. And I've seen Paul present. He gives up his time to talk to my students in Liverpool. When the Albion are playing at Liverpool or they're playing at Everton, he'll always turn in on the Friday before the match, which is incredibly generous. You know, he's a man running a £200 million a year business, and he's willing to give up an afternoon of his time. It's indicative, I think, of his generosity, but also the fact that he's just a damn good bloke. But his philosophy and that of Tony in terms of the culture of the club is that if you walk in through the front door and the tea lady or the kit person or whoever it is gives you a smile and says, how are you doing? That makes you walk slightly taller. Now, that doesn't matter whether you're another person on administration or a player or a coach. We all react to positive feedback. And if you do that on a cumulative basis, if you do that as an organisation, it's one of those marginal gains that, yeah, we see that Manchester United have recruited Sir Dave Brailsford, who was successful with cycling with that regard. Well, this is trying to be successful by being decent. And yeah, it's a word which is not used in modern day society very much. But it can make a difference. And if you all point in the same direction, if you all support each other, such as the way that the bonus scheme operates throughout the whole club, it's acknowledging your efforts it makes you work that little bit harder. The club benefits on the pitch, off the pitch.
Yeah. I mean, these days, I mean, the club give the kit man a TV show. I mean, can you imagine Jock Riddell doing like Jock's movie?
But getting back to I mean, because you don't have a transfer fee for managers. You have, quote, compensation. I mean, tomato, tomato. But remind me, Kieran, it's still the highest compensation paid for a league manager anywhere in the world, isn't it?
It is. That might change this summer. And I think, I've just been on Sky Sports News and just been watching Sky Sports News. It would appear that Liverpool are not pursuing Roberto, but I'm aware that one of their other targets does have a buyout clause of around about 30 to 40 million. We've seen that Newcastle have given a buyout clause to Manchester United in respect of Dan Ashworth of 20 million. They similarly had to pay out to the Albion because, again, Tony and Paul, they thought, Dan's a good recruit. We will give him a long period of gardening leave unless you are prepared to financially compensate us.
So the figures, the headline figures we're talking about here is, I mean, you've given it in terms of the Albion's history, but prior to coming on here, we talked about it's now, again, perhaps if you can give us the layman's version, if you can be a latter-day Ed Basford and put things into plain English for us, is... something about the highest pre-tax or highest post-tax in, well, say in Premier League history. We're going to say Premier League history. We're going to say Football League history as well. But there's kind of, we've done that well that we've actually, as it were, as the Norwegian commentator would say, we've beaten them all.
But that's correct. The Albion made £123 million profit after tax. And for people not familiar with profit, it's the money that the clubs generated from ticket sales, from broadcasting, from the commercial deals and the deals on the players, less the costs of running the club, less the costs of wages, overheads. And remember, we've got overheads at the Albion that no other club has to deal with, such as the transport subsidy. Mm. So that is the highest in Premier League history. It exceeds that of Spurs, which was made in 2018. And Spurs that season had the benefit of going from Wembley Stadium to the new Spurs Stadium. So all of the financial benefits that involved a switch from one venue to another and the fact that they'd sold out and they got so much money in advance from ticket sales from moving to the new stadium. So it's a hell of an achievement. At the very same time as the Albion were announcing these results, Leicester City, who won the Premier League in 2016, they announced a loss of £90 million, and they only did that through some, I wouldn't say shenanigans, because it's all illegal, but through some sort of shifting of the sands, which allowed them to sell a James Maddison just before the end of the season. Otherwise, they'd have lost £130 million. Leicester City were what we wanted to be 7 years ago.
But this is a similar situation to Nottingham Forest, though, isn't it? Where they were trying to sell Brennan Johnson just prior to the 30th of June, so they wouldn't get themselves into trouble with the FFP stuff. So, I mean, losing 90 million quid is just that's just it's stupid, isn't it?
Well, it is, but at the Albion, for every £100 that came through the door, the Albion spent 62 on wages. At Leicester City, for every £100 that came through the door, the club spent 116 on wages and got relegated. So, yeah, there weren't even that many win bonuses to pay last season. It's indicative of a club which has taken its eye off the ball. And yeah, I cannot see this happening with the management team that we have, but you only have to have one bad season if you're... Yeah. A club the size of Leicester or the Albion, and let's face it, yeah, they're not that far apart in terms of the capacity at the ground and so on, in terms of the generosity of the owner. Leicester won the Premier League through getting things right. 7 or 8 years later, they're in the Championship. They're facing a points deduction in respect of these losses in all probability and so on.
I was about to say, bearing in mind, as you pointed out, it's not the road, it's not the financial model that or the business model at the Albion go down. But like I say, it's only been 8 years since Leicester won the Premier League. What's the cautionary tale that other, well, Brighton certainly, but they've probably already learned it. What's the cautionary tale that everyone else should learn from them? Where have they gone so drastically wrong that, you know, or is it a general malaise that you can see happening across Everton, Forest and others?
Well, I think if you look at those three clubs in particular, they've all followed the route of, and to be fair, Leicester's was on the back of success, of thinking that spending bigger will bring bigger rewards. It doesn't. Spending bigger brings you a bigger wage bill. If you take a look at those clubs in particular, their recruitment policy is politely described as hit and miss. And it could also be argued, you know, let's be honest, when the Albion first came to the Premier League, the Albion's recruitment policy was far from perfect. You know, we won't mention the players by name, but I think we all know who we're talking about. And that was substantial amounts of money. I think the club reflected on that, decided on a different strategy, looked for different markets, brought in experience as well. And I think we cannot, even though they don't necessarily play every match for 90 minutes, the benefits of having James Milner, Adam Lallana, and so on around the ground does make an impact in terms of helping to develop the players coming through. But the Albion have gone for a particular market in terms of, you know, Barco's cost, what, 9 million, and Kiso cost 9 million, Moises cost 4.5 million. In terms of promising players at a particular age of their career. And I think we've now moved slightly on from that. You know, in terms of João Pedro was 30. We've got Belaiba somewhere between 21 and 26, depending on who you believe. So I think the club is moving cautiously, but that has been the approach, cautious, incremental growth.
Yeah. So you say that, I mean, you were talking about Leicester as, like I said, the cautionary tale. And you use the phrase there, you can only have one bad season and dot, dot, dot. I mean, how much of a cushion at the moment, from what you can glean from the figures that you've got and the cumulative figures since we got promoted, how much of a cushion do we have at the moment that we could ride out a bad season? Can we ride out one? Can we ride out two? Where are we at in terms of how a bad season would affect us?
I think the Albion are pretty much shockproof for 2 or 3 years. And to give you an indication of that, based on the figures that I've got in front of me, the net spend on transfers in the seven seasons we've now been in the Premier League, the net spend over those 7 seasons is £20 million.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which is...
We spend £20 million more than we received, yes?
Yeah. In 7 years, could you imagine any other club?
And I was about to say, if you got if that averages out at just under £3 million a year, and I'm sure there's some kind of flash Excel based accounting figure for that that says, well, actually, we've only spent £3 million a year, but you can imagine fans of other clubs will be screaming blue murder. Where is our sense of priority? Where is our sense of ambition? We've only spent an average of £3 million a year. Look and learn.
I think so. I mean, there is a view outside of Brighton circles that you know, because we spent £30 million on João Pedro in the summer, that because we spent £20 million on Belaiba, that we're now going to be going out and spending massive amounts of money and breaking our transfer record every year. So I just can't see that happening.
It will be done if the club believes that there is value in that transfer. You know, if João Pedro hadn't had an injury and he continued to display the talents which he had before his injury, we potentially will be looking at a player sale this summer in the region of £70 to £80 million.
Yeah.
So I don't see the Albion being afraid to spend money. They will look at it from the point of view of, can this player improve the club? For how many years do we think he can improve the club? And if we sign him on a long-term contract, what do we realistically feel his ceiling is in terms of the market in a few years' time?
I mean, it's something that we're doing right now, though, isn't it? I mean, it's very... I mean, it's obviously not in this year's accounts, and we'll definitely see it in next year's accounts. And I think the fact that we've got so much money from Moyes is probably did counterbalance this a little bit. But the amount we're paying for Ansu Fati to come on loan is disproportionate to everybody else.
It is in terms of wages, but if I'm a sporting director, but also if I'm a financial controller, I always look at the total cost of employing a player over one season. So in respect of Ansu Fati, if we are paying 80% of his wages and it means that it costs the club £6 million for a year, well, Yao Pedro is at £30 million on a five-year contract. That works out as £6 million from his transfer fee, full stop, and that's before you add on his wages. So I think the Ansu Fati deal was an intriguing one. He's still got a lot to offer. We've got 9 games remaining. I think given the injuries, he's certainly got an opportunity to demonstrate that what he showed in Amsterdam and elsewhere and can be replicated on a more regular basis.
So these figures that have come out, therefore the financial year to the year end, is it correct, 30th of June 2023, yes?
That's correct, yes.
Right, so the start of the financial year will always be 1st of July. Now, here we are, we're recording this on the 2nd of April, so we've got just under 3 months to go of this current financial year. Now, we mentioned you mentioned in your notes that we finished 6th, which obviously gets us a bonus, you know, the what do you call it, the hierarchy bonus,
the merit bonus.
Yeah. But also we've had, you know, every single game has been 30,000 plus, so we've had the people in and we've had those extra, we haven't had the extra cup games, but we have had the extra European games. So given what we know roughly as to how things are going to happen, and I don't know if the final table is going to be the final determinant. And like I said, we've got the Cucurella and the Sanchez money to consider. Would you expect to see the club making a not dissimilar profit for next year's accounts? Or, again, is it too soon to consider it? Or where are we at with that?
Do I think £100 million plus profit is achievable? Certainly. Even if we finish, you know, 9th or 10th, that'll be a little bit less money coming in from the TV deal, but that will be replaced in terms of the progress that the club made in Europe was worth somewhere in the region of £20 to £22 million in prize money from UEFA. So there's that to factor in. I'd expect the wage bill to rise a good 10% or so, because they've had to increase the size of the squad, because as we've seen throughout the season, that Sunday, Thursday routine, which we were in for a while during the group stages of the Europa League, meant that you did have to have a more talented and a more experienced squad to be able to deal with it. In terms of the player sale profits, Moises Caicedo, we're looking at a profit in the region of £110 million. Robert Sanchez, academy player, profit of £25 million. So you've got profits of £135 million from those two alone. I think we would be looking at substantial profits. I don't think they'll match the numbers of this year, but they won't be that far behind.
So actually what will happen is where we've got the highest ever pre-tax profit, next year we'll just come up with the second highest ever. There we are, numbers 1 and 2. I just want to take sort of, you know, I'm being a little bit flippant here, because one, I don't 100% understand everything that's going on here, and I'm grateful to you, Kieran, to coming on and explaining this in plain English. But obviously we made a modest profit last year, but even then we were unusual in as much as we made a profit. We've made a huge one this year. We're looking to make another possibly comfortable eight-figure profit next year. This is unprecedented, isn't it? Probably in the history of English football, I guess.
Yes. I mean, I think Spurs had a sort of a golden period just before COVID, when they moved to the new stadium. And what Spurs are very good at doing is not spending a lot of money on wages. In some of those seasons, they were only spending £39 on wages for every £100 that was coming through the door. So they had sort of a golden period of two or three seasons. I think the Albion will certainly make profits in 23-24. But had they not sold those players and had Graham not departed to Chelsea with that compensation, they would have lost money. So, you know, it is very much dependent upon non-day-to-day factors in terms of converting losses into profits.
So given where we are at the moment, here we are, like I say, 2nd of April, just discussing these new figures that have come out. One, what grading would you give Tony and the board for how they're running the club? I mean, as much as we say, oh, they're well run. Well, and I'd say the grade, not even in comparison to everyone else, I'd say in terms of a business model. And two, what state are we in? I mean, how do you see the next sort of 3 to 5 years?
In terms of doing assessments, you'd look at the key performance indicators, which I know is sort of a middle management phrase.
Yeah, but it's good.
In terms of outputs, the club finished 6th in the Premier League, which is the highest position in the club's history. The fact that they did that with the 13th largest wage bill, and football is a talent game and talent follows the money, I think is a huge plus. The fact that they did that with the lowest costing squad in the Premier League is another huge plus. So to give them anything less than an A+, I think we're talking an A++ in as far as I'm concerned here, would be really churlish. Do I think that they will become complacent on the back of that? Well, they certainly won't do with Roberto as coach, because if you listen to Paul Barber when he spoke on Sky recently, he said he thinks the club is lacking ambition in the sense that Tony Bloom says he wants us to be a regular top 10 club. Roberto said, well, why can't we be a top 6 club? And if he's challenging the players and his coaching team and Paul Barber and Tony Bloom, because that's what he wants, then I suspect that they will react positively to that, with a view to saying, well, okay, why can't we? Let's face it.
Absolutely.
If we'd kept Alexis McAllister, I know we're moving on to the... I think we would have made further progress, because he's just been incredible for Liverpool this season, and he was pretty incredible for us last season. But he's such an understated player, playing for an understated club, that he probably didn't get the recognition he deserved, apart from winning the World Cup.
Yeah, I know, Don, you're breaking my heart, Gary.
But having said that, very few football clubs could ever hope, and let's face it, all right, we've gone from so far 6th to 8/9th. We've not been below 10th this season, but when you offload probably the best midfield pairing of Caicedo and McAllister in one fell swoop, it's going to be, you know, it is like getting
a massive
punch in the face, isn't it? It's virtually impossible to replace a pairing like that. And I wouldn't say it's not fair on Billy Gilmore and Pascal Gross to say they've done a decent job in replacement. But when you see that Caicedo and McAllister are so far ahead, certainly were for us, Caicedo's just gone to the wrong club. That's his lookout. But and I was saying this on the Anfield Wrap, if Caicedo had gone to Liverpool alongside McAllister, I would be of the opinion, only an opinion, I reckon Liverpool would have won the title by now.
Possibly, absolutely. I mean, that is a pairing. It's when you lose such that and you don't have necessarily the time to replace it, it is going to leave a massive hole in your team and in your squad. And you know, Belabor's has come in. We know he's not a direct replacement. He's a very, very different player.
Still a work in progress, isn't he?
He's a work in progress, and he's going to get better, and we're seeing him get better. But yeah, I mean, but the other thing I was going to mention, though, Kieran, was obviously when other clubs, not just in this country, but across the world, see these figures, I mean, I don't think there is such a thing as what you would call an Albion tax, but would they be putting extra zeros on the top on the transfer fees because of that, or are they not that callous?
Football is the most callous and vicious and untrustworthy industry going. They might try it, but again, one thing that you know about the Albion special sauce, for want of a better phrase, is that they very much do have their own view as to what is an appropriate price to pay. We've got in Tony, one of the world's best poker players. Well, he knows when to stick and when to twist. Nobody better than that. And Paul is very good at doing the negotiations and implementing the perspective that they have. And the relationship that the club have with Star Lizard is the club is paying Star Lizard now £3 million a year for consultancy advice. And I think what we are seeing there is the ability to go into those other markets. £4.5 million for Moises Caicedo at the time was a really good price. £9 million for Nkiso was a very good price as far as the selling clubs were concerned. Yeah. It was the same for Alexis.
Yeah, $8 million, wasn't it, Alexis?
Yep. So all of the selling clubs were happy. I think selling clubs would actually be quite proud to be associated with Brighton Hove Albion, that their players have been spotted by what is considered to be not just one of the countries, but one of the world's best organisations at spotting talent, because it's showing that that selling club itself has developed a talented player.
Yeah, that's true.
Right. We'll move on to Show of the Week, but I just want to close this particular section by asking one thing. Now, obviously, Tony Bloom has, put in out of his own pocket figures that are eye-watering. I think as of the previous year, I could be wrong. It's probably highly fluid, but let's say £490 million for the sake of this argument, with probably Todd Bowley coming in a very close second. But is there any truth in the reports that we're reading that the club might be in a position to pay Tony a few quid back, money which, incidentally, I don't think one single Brighton fan would ever begrudge him because of the enormous risk that he himself took in taking on the entire project. Is there any credence in that?
Yeah, the club did repay him £36 million in 22-23. The previous season, he'd lent the club more money, even though we'd had a successful 21-22. Tony's relationship with the Albion is such that the loans are interest free. So I was on a Wrexham podcast this morning. Reynolds and McElhenney, who have done a fantastic job in improving the profile of Wrexham as a town, and any of us who were at Fans United Day at Wrexham, and I was
20 years ago,
know the struggles that club has had. They're charging 8% interest. We had David Gold and David Sullivan charge £45 million in interest to West Ham in respect of that club. And you do see it from other owners. Tony has lent a ludicrous amount of money to the Albion, interest-free, which has allowed the club to spend more money on recruiting talent, on giving us the stadium where... You and I, we all go to away matches, and then you remember, blimey, my seat at the Amex is dead comfy. I'm 6'3". I can't sit in half of the grounds in this country. I have to stand. I probably choose to stand anyway. I cannot physically sit down because I'm too tall. And yet at the Albion, we are looked after ridiculously well. Again, that's on the back of Tony Bloom's benevolence as a fan towards other fans. And it's partly due to the fact that he's lent that money interest free.
Yeah, I think they need to give you a nice little footstool as well. Maybe someone come give you a little massage, foot massage.
Foot bath, you mean, and sort of like one of those bubble things with a little fish inside the water. Yeah.
No, you're not allowed to do that anymore, apparently. But,
all right, okay.
Anyway, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. As ever, we're brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com, and Phil has given us a rather fetching little jersey to have a look at this week. And Kieran, can you describe this shirt for me?
I'm colourblind, so descriptions aren't my strong point. But It's mainly blue. It's got a series of chevrons. It reminds me quite a bit of the old Chelsea shirt that you'd associate with Kerry Dixon and David Speedy in terms of those lines. So it's light blue with darker blue with chevrons, which could be green or red. Phil Shelley will say that it doesn't really matter. They're both the same, and both Phil and I are both colorblind. It's got a nice little collar, a button-up collar, and the badge on the left side looks very old school. It looks like the crest of a city or a town. Yeah. And as for the manufacturer, it's not one. Yeah, it's something like that. Yeah.
Didn't we have Super Sport at one point?
I remember. Can I have a guess at this? Because I think I might know.
Go on then.
I mean, it's interesting talking about the badge because once upon a time, until about the 70s, football clubs used to have the town crest as their badge. Brighton and Hove Albion did. I mean, it had a kind of a joint one. I mean, I just remember QPR had the London Borough of Hammersmith, for crying out loud, until such time as graphic designers came along. I think this is Stockport County, isn't it?
Well, I mean, why would Phil, like, knowing that Kieran was coming on the show, do anything like choose a Stockport County shirt? I mean, why would he do that, Kieran?
As a former resident of the fine hatting town of Stockport, yes, he's actually right. I do recall seeing Stockport in this, thinking about it twice.
Is it Stockport?
It is Stockport. Oh, this is what Phil has to say about this particular jersey. Is it? Here is your shirt of the week, chosen because your guest really should guess it. This is the 93-94 home shirt of League Two side Stockport County. The side was formed in 1883 and originally played in red and white kits. However, in 1914, they saw the light and changed to blue and white kits. Home is a 10,852 capacity Edgeley Park Stadium in Stockport, where they've been since 1902, and they are nicknamed the Hatters after the town's former hat-making industry. Stockport first joined the league in 1900, and they were re-elected in 1904. They then spent 106 consecutive seasons in the Football League, including 5 seasons in what we now call the Championship in the 1990s. They made the semi-final of the League Cup in 97 and to date have played 4 times at Wembley. In 2011, they were relegated to the Conference League and a year later to the Conference North. In 2021, though, they gained promotion back to the Football League and at the time of writing, they sit top of League Two. Stockport stole a march on Albion by appointing a Uruguayan manager, a certain Danny Bigara, in 1989. He stayed for 6 years and led them to the playoffs in his first season, promotion to the third tier, League One, in 1990-91, and in 91-92 to the final of the Football League Trophy and the playoff final, losing both games at Wembley. In 1993, they lost their playoff semi-final to Port Vale. And then in the final of the Orsa Glass Trophy at Wembley, they lost to Port Vale again. In 93-94 playoff semi-final, they lost to Burnley and had 2 players sent off. You remember who the ref was in that game? Any ideas?
Not one clue.
It was the first time the same side had 2 players dismissed at Wembley, according to this. It was David Ellery.
He of Harrow.
Yeah. There are loads of notable former players, and he's picked some of them for you. George Best made 3 appearances in 1976, scoring twice. Jim Gannon made 383 appearances for the Hatters between 1990 and 2000. Brett Angel had 3 stints at Edgeley Park. There was Mickey Quinn. He was there between 82 and 83, turning out 63 times, scoring 39 goals. And bizarrely, Derek Acora had a stint with Stockport in the 80s. Plenty of links to the Albion. Frank Worthington was with us in 83-84 and his short stint at Stockport in 87-88. Malcolm Poskett was with us in the 70s. He ended up at Stockport for a season in 85. Gary Dicker, Liam Bridcut, Chris O'Grady and Craig Davis all put on Brighton and Stockport shirts. And goalkeepers who have played for both include Mark Cartwright, Alan Blaney, Steve Harper and John Keeley. And let's not forget
Kieran Maguire, he spent many a Friday evening on the terraces of Edgeley Park during his time living in Manchester.
You see, I've heard you talk about your time going to Stockport. You used to go there on a Friday and somewhere else on a Saturday, isn't that right?
That's right. When I was a student, it was so cheap to watch football in Manchester, and you know, travelling back to Brighton wasn't that easy. So it would be either Rochdale or Stockport on a Friday night and Manchester United or Manchester City on a Saturday afternoon.
Now, you mentioned at the top of the that particular section there about your colour blindness. Now, about 18 months or so ago, we had someone on from the Colour Blind Awareness, and there's yourself and Phil Shelley happy to acknowledge your colour blindness and wanting the Premier League to do something about what are effectively hit clashes for you. Now, since that particular conversation on the Raw about 18 months ago, has there really been any progress?
Not particularly. The Premier League does have a nominal colourblindness awareness campaign, and in theory, they should compare the... There's a filter that you can use to compare what a shirt looks like to a fully colour vision person and a colourblind person. But it doesn't appear to have been used as often as it can. It's an issue, but you're also fighting against legacy. So I do not watch Wales versus Ireland because red and green are the same to me. People say, well, how is that the case? If you're colorblind, the best way to think about it is looking at things on a grayscale. You know, I can discern dark from light, but you know, red, a mid red and a mid green are probably both in the 4 or 5. So I'm looking at that shirt over AD's shoulder, and I know it's an old Albion shirt. Now I'm not certain whether it's our green and black or our red and black one. Whereas to a fully colour vision person, they go, well, yeah, that's really easy. So why is it an issue? Well, it's because 8% of men are colourblind. So that's 1 in 12. That means that on a football pitch, potentially you've got two people, potentially that could also be a referee or a referee's assistant who are colourblind. I remember when I used to be a referee, and I used to do sort of Sunday league football, but I'd also do county league on a Saturday as a lino. And some of the times I had no idea, you know, whether I was looking at a forward or a defender in terms of trying to put up my flag.
What colour was the flag?
Well, flags were okay. The flags were yellow. Yellow is nice and easy to work out, unless you're playing against somebody in orange.
Yeah. But actually, I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned that Ireland-Wales rugby game, because I think for the first time, there was a bit of a furore about it in certainly across social media, where people were talking about the colourblind awareness. And it was, I think that's the first time that actually people actually are voicing their opinion. So there is a change is happening. It's going to take some time, but it is happening. I mean, I know Plymouth as well have gone on record as saying they are actually making sure that their kit does not clash with anybody else for colourblind reasons now. But and obviously, as a team, where the wears green, it can be quite a tricky thing for them, really.
But the thing about social media, what came up on social media was, like you say, it's the first time that it's raised its head. But in response is, and I think Kieran used the word, legacy. Because it hasn't been an issue before, then why is it an issue now? Oh, my God, we're just appealing to the woke generation. It's only 99.99%. Well, we've actually just worked out. We know it's not. It's 92%. It's still over 90%. But actually, you know, on average, and I think I've done the back of a fag packet calculations on this as to how many, on average, colourblind men there would be at an average home game at the Amex. And it's something like 2,500. That's an astonishing number. If we're talking about going across society as a whole. And this is not to be sniffed at. Now, we've had the heads up on it, but I just cannot, for the life of me, understand why people are so upset about it, just because, well, it's not about the fact that people haven't necessarily raised it before. It's just people haven't been listened to.
Yeah, this is true. But you know what else we've been given a heads up about, Al?
What else is that then, AD?
We've been given the heads up that come at the end of the month, there is another Reverb upon, Alan.
There is. Well, Radio Reverb is a community radio station. It only survives financially on donations, grants, and sponsorship. So we're grateful for the, where are we now, 12th? No, 14th year of the sponsorship of oldfootballshirts.com for the Albion Roar, which helps to keep the Radio Reverb station going. Like I say, it's a community radio station serving Brighton and Hove, but actually if you're lucky like me, where I'm down in Goring-by-Sea, I can actually still pick it up, even though I shouldn't, which means don't tell Ofcom that our transmitter's too powerful. In order to raise funds to keep us going, we have to pay rent, we have to pay rates, we have to pay licenses. In order to do so, we're having a Reverbathon. So the weekend of the 27th and 28th of April, we've been helped a little bit by the Bournemouth game moving. We're going to do something we haven't done for 4 years, and that is have a go at presenting a live show. Now, we're not going
to... Oh, dear.
Yes, well, what could go wrong? So the 27th of April, we're live on air at 5 o'clock in the afternoon as the results come in. If you do feel like donating, please go to radioreverb.com/donate. Or if you feel like sponsoring us, then drop us a line at thealbionraw@yahoo.co.uk. Meanwhile, we probably will be actually going out there and asking people. So if you're not going to volunteer, we're going to ask you anyway. Yes,
we will hunt you down and we will find you.
Yeah, we're not exactly Liam Neeson, but we'll give it a go. 27th, 28th is the Reverbathon. In order to keep Radio Reverb, this brilliant community project, on air, please get involved.
Yeah. But I'm curious. I mean, you are in your stomping ground of where you work. So it was a nice, easy one for you. Obviously, result didn't quite go away, but it started so well.
Yeah, I think it was a great goal as well from Danny. So that was a good start. I felt it was a fairly even game for a while, and then Liverpool started to show their dominance, and they certainly dominated for all the mid periods of the game. Bit unlucky with the equaliser, the way that Joel Veltman just cushioned it for Diaz. But Alexis McAllister, as we mentioned earlier, was just like a quarterback in the way that he was launching balls perfectly for Mo Salah. And it was fairly inevitable that Salah was going to score, given that he was given any chances.
I mean, I've got written down here that after Welbeck scored his rocket after 90 seconds, then began the Salah showreel of missed opportunities, mostly created by Alexis. But we should point out that that was the 100th Premier League game for Danny Welbeck, which is more than he's played for anybody else, which is absolute delight. He's obviously like happy here. But he did also have a lot of... He did score the rocket, but he did also have a lot of other opportunities where he could have possibly put the under back.
If you're really talking about taking the opportunities that came both teams' way, then the game should have finished something like 17-5.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Liverpool had 30 shots attempts at goal, 8 on target. We only had 9.
Right,
3 on target.
No, I mean, I totally agree with Kieran. It looked like a fairly even Steven game for the first 20 minutes, but then once McAllister... Who himself is, I mean, it's a kind of a microcosm of him being there, and I suppose a microcosm of him being here. He took a while to settle in. You know, they liked, Liverpool fans liked him once he arrived, but they're thinking, okay, yeah, he did well for Brighton. You know, he turned us over a couple of times. You know, McAllister and Caicedo, they would pull the strings, because you think the three games against Liverpool last season, we were absolutely brilliant in all of them, and even the, I think it was the league game where we won 3-0. I mean, Klopp said he could have carried on playing until midnight and the winner scored. But then that's because you had the likes of McAllister and Caicedo playing against Liverpool, playing against Brighton. It was murder.
Yeah, going in there without 7 first-choice players as well. Of that, we've just lost Billy Gilmore as well, to add his name to the list. And there was no one, Ciso, Pedro, Matoma, March, Hinshelwood, and Milner. So, I mean, those are all players that would start games for us. That's a big miss.
Yes, but I think that also you could put all 7 of them on McAllister and he'd still perform like that. I mean, you've got to say this, Kieran. How good was McAllister?
And he was superb. He's economical with the ball. He's got a vision. He can tackle. He can be dirty if he has to. He can play in any midfield position, you know, as a deep lying player, as more central, just behind the striker. He's very flat. He's still only 24 years of age. I know people are saying, or Liverpool fans, I think in particular, are saying, well, he only costs £35 million. He's an absolute bargain. Sort of link the two topics we've got together today. If you take a look in the Albion accounts, it does say that there are potential add-ons from player sales of £40 million. I would suggest that a substantial amount of that could be in relation to Alexis McAllister. So if Albion fans don't know who they want to win the Premier League this season, from a purely selfish and financial point of view, get singing You'll Never Walk Alone.
Yes.
Yeah. And obviously now we're out of the competition as well. There's a potential that there could be European success for Alexis as well. So
I'm just trying to do the back of the fag packet calculations here, because I'm just thinking...
God, have you taken up smoking? You're doing a lot of those today.
Well, yeah. I mean, I just nicked them from the skip outside. if it's 40 minutes, I'm just trying to think who else we would have sold in that time. I'm just thinking, well, Caicedo, there might have been the odd add-on, but that doesn't count in the accounts. And I can't think of anyone. Trossard, maybe a couple of extra quid. Ben White, was he sold in that year, or was that the year before?
He was sold before.
So
I think Cucurella definitely had some add-ons. I mean, getting Spanish caps and things like that.
It went about to about sort of 6 or 7 million, didn't they? I mean, this is what's reported. And we're back to Paul Camelin telling us that anything you read in the press just doesn't have the clout, because the club don't tell anyone until such time as the accounts come out. And that's when Kieran becomes Fabricazio Romano. Being on the Anfield Wrap earlier this week, or early last week, I mean, they're nervous. They were always nervous of playing us just because of how well we've done so. But you could clearly see that they were a better side. And Kieran, I mean, do you think the 2-1 was one we got away with, or do you think it was a fair result?
I think the score probably reflected the overall balance. Certainly for the last 10 or 15 minutes of the game, the Albion were back and looking very sharp. I think we did. And also, I think you've got to give a lot of admiration to Liverpool for the fact that they were trying to score a third. Mm. You know, that they weren't... We've been to some matches this season where the opposition are one up going into the last 5 or 10 minutes, and it becomes game management and keep possession and being awkward. Liverpool under Klopp, I don't think they're capable of doing that, and I don't think the Albion are capable of doing that either when they're one goal up.
Well, I think there is also the issue that in their title running, they've got the third best of the three's goal difference. So if they're looking to increase that at every opportunity, then I think it's understandable.
But as for this week, that is all we've got time for. So thank you so much, as ever, to Kieran Maguire. Thank you to Alan Wares. I've been Ailey Packham. This has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast, and in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you all again next week. Cheers and bye.